Hi, this is Dan Held.
And this is Gary Leland, and you're listening to episode 138 of the Crypto Cousins Podcast.
Feed your interest in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies by joining Hall of Fame podcaster Gary Leland on the Crypto Cousins Podcast. And remember, we are all cousins in the world of crypto. This week's price of Bitcoin:
$9,728. That's up $852 or 9.5% over the past 7 days. Howdy, howdy, howdy. Dan, welcome to... wait a second. I owe you another howdy. Howdy, 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 howdy. We give Texans 4 howdies.
That's right. And actually, I went to Texas A&M, so that's the howdy resonates very loudly.
You know, my daughter graduated from A&M and my son-in-law graduated from A&M. So whoop, whoop.
The good people.
Yeah, yeah. We weren't sure about that. My daughter was going to go to Tech, and then out of the blue, she got accepted at A&M. So
I think she came to her senses, you know.
She met her husband there. He was in the Corps. And now he's a major in the Air Force. And they really had a good time. You know, A&M, for people who aren't familiar with A&M, they really are a tight bunch, those Aggies.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. A lot of people don't know this sort of backstory on me because I live in San Francisco and I go fly to New York all the time for work. And most people in New York and San Francisco don't really know about Texas A&M. But Texas A&M is a kind of, an old-fashioned Texas sort of university, just very 100% Texan style. I'm trying to think through how to award this for those West Coast, East Coast folks. But yeah, it's very Texas.
It's very Texas. And their hatred for the University of Texas is amazing. You know, but getting back to how tight a knit group A&M is, when my daughter was a senior in high school, you know, she got accepted to A&M and we decided to go to Panama for a couple weeks. And so we went to Panama. We were in the airport in Panama and my daughter has her A&M sweatshirt on. And this old guy, at the time he seemed old, he probably was my age, I don't know, but comes over and is like, "Hey, Giggum, I'm an A&M graduate from 19, whatever," and starts talking to my daughter and saying, "Hey, you know, here's my..." Give her a card, said, "You know, if you're an A&M, you never get in trouble, give me a call. I'd be glad to help another Aggie." And it was just, we were like, wow, these Aggies really take care of each other.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Texas A&M, like when the amount of like cohesion between the different students and like the football team is enormous. So, for example, like the entire crowd, the entire university, so all the legacy folks and the new one and all the new students, they all memorize the chants. So you've got 100,000 Aggies all chanting the same thing during football games, which makes Kyle Field one of the most intimidating stadiums to play at because you've got 100,000 people coordinated. But yeah, more so than that, I think it's, you know, I like the idea of having traditions. It makes the college experience a little bit more fun. Texans aren't like the coasts. You know, we don't have a 400-year-old university, right? Texans kind of have to make their own culture. And I think A&M is one of the richest cultures for university life in Texas.
I always have to laugh at Aggies when I'm at an Aggie football game and the game's over. And if they're not playing Texas, they're singing a song about Texas, University of Texas, about how they hate them. And I wonder if someone from another city plays or goes to the game for the first time because they're a visiting team, do they go, "What in the hell is going on? They didn't play Texas today."
Well, it's one of the oldest rivalries in college football. But, you know, I think with Aggies, there's just that huge passion when it comes to the game. So I definitely agree. We come across pretty quirky. And it's been a while since I've hung out with a lot of Aggies. I still have a bunch of friends who are Aggies. I've got a couple of buddies who moved out to San Francisco. You know, but out here on the West Coast, it's not as intense or kind of, popular as it is, of course, in Texas.
Well, you're from McKinney, so that's in North Texas over here. What made you move to San Francisco?
Yeah, close, up by Plano, so North Dallas. So I grew up in Plano. I moved out to San Francisco in January 2013, and that was because a small investment firm I worked for relocated me out here because they wanted me to open up their West Coast portfolio. So a kind of coincidence of a lucky random roll of the dice with a combination of me really feeling strongly about tech and Bitcoin. That's when, you know, in March 2013, I decided to build my first product called Zero Block. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I became obsessed with how do great people build mobile products? How do they grow those? Learned everything I needed to on the internet and from like really sharp people in the space. You know, Twitter's a phenomenal resource, and used that and made ZeroBlock the most popular crypto app in 2013, which was a pretty cool experience. And we got acquired by blockchain.com. So I kind of stumbled and bumbled my way into tech.
So that was your first business that you built and sold?
That's right. First business I ever built and sold, and first crypto business.
So how did you find out about crypto? What got you into Bitcoin? Because, I mean, if you sold a company in 2013, then you had to know enough by that time to know Bitcoin or crypto or whatever was the real deal, or you felt it was. So you had to be in it a little while at that time. So tell us your, I guess, discovery story. Or
also, I've been doing some digging with my emails as well to help me color in this past, because it is a very, very long time ago. I registered my first account at Mt. Gox in December 2011. And then in 2011, my buddy paid me back for a beer with a Casatius coin. So one of those physical coins. Yep. And that kind of like kickstarted my thought process into like, okay, well, I was already libertarian and I felt like non-state money was, you know, like gold, you know, was a pretty important thing for me. I believed that, you know, we needed a sound money to bring this. I was in college during the 2008 financial crisis studying finance and realized that this whole system was fundamentally broken. And I felt like a return to sound money was the way that we go forward. And so for me, it pretty clearly represented gold 2.0. You know, so I got that Casatius coin, I started to dig into it, and I'm like, oh, a disinflationary monetary policy? This is incredible. This is the holy grail. Yeah, the problem that we have is there's no proper inflation rate. It's impossible to choose what an appropriate rate of inflation would be, and it would always be subject to political whims. So to have a hard cap, he removed that human element from the decision-making process with the monetary policy, which I thought was brilliant. And I considered like the largest breakthrough of Bitcoin.
Those Casatius coins, they're kind of a collectible now, aren't they? I mean, are they still around?
Yeah, they are collectible. I mean, they're somewhat risky because you trust that the private key generation ceremony, that they didn't copy those keys. But to the best of my knowledge, I don't think anyone's had a Casatius key where they found like the original creator of Casatius, you know, copied that private key and stole those funds from them. It still requires some trust. But yeah, they are the quintessential gold coins that you see on all those articles. If it's about Bitcoin, you're going to see that gold shiny coin.
And I guess on the back from the, I think someone gave me one that didn't have any money on it. It was like, or maybe it was made later, but it looks like on the back, it had a hologram that you peeled off.
That's
right. And then under there was the QR code or whatever. I assumed I didn't peel it off to get your Bitcoin off of it.
Yeah, that's right. You'd have your private key under that would be underneath the peeled off holographic. The holographic element represented like, you know, still sealed in a way.
Right. I may need to look. There may be some Bitcoin. Well, not one I have. I've never taken it off the check. I may want to check. There may be something under there.
You could check. I mean, I wonder, I forget if there's an external number on the coin where you can go check the balance.
Oh.
I forget. You might want to check that. But
I'll have to pull it up and see what I can figure out from looking at that. Now, you said you started, that was your first business. Did you have another business you said you started and sold?
Yeah, so that was the first business I started and sold. So that was at blockchain.com in December 2013, which, by the way, that was the second ever Bitcoin company acquisition. First one was Eric Voorhees' Satoshi Dice. And after that, worked at Blockchain, then worked at a startup called ChangeTip, which did micropayments over social media using Bitcoin. Went to Uber, left Uber, went back to crypto. I should clarify, I went back to Bitcoin, to be clear.
Thanks.
Went back to Bitcoin, co-founded a company called Interchange, which did post-trade reconciliation for institutional traders. And then we were bought by Kraken in July 2019. So that's kind of the round trip journey of Dan's experience in Bitcoin.
And is that how you got to Kraken, where you're at now?
That's right. Yeah. So after we were acquired, I was put on the business development team, which we felt like was a really strong fit for my background and my connections.
Okay. Yeah. So now I got the scoop on Dan.
Yep. It's the Dan TLDR.
We met at, I think we met for the first time at Tone's event this February.
Yeah, I was glad.
Unconfiscatable.
Yeah, I was glad that we could both make that. I mean, that was my last conference I've been to this year, and it's always fun hanging out with good Bitcoiners, and that was a great time.
You know, I think Tone really lucked up there because he got that in like at the last minute. I mean, if it had been 2 weeks later, he might not have got that in. So, I mean, that was like perfect timing, but that may have been the last conference of any, besides a meetup of any size at all for this whole year.
Yeah. Yeah, that very well could be. I mean, I just don't see a scenario where people are going to large in-person, you know, meetings like conferences or concerts. I think those are basically off the table for 2020. Maybe 2021 we see people coming in, but, you know, I think you'd have to see like a really huge decline in like the number of infected cases. I mean, certainly if like only one person in my city is infected, okay, maybe I'll risk it to go to like a conference, right? Yeah. Like, I think that's a pretty low risk, but you know, it's kind of a subjective, even if these limits of our movement are removed by the government, individuals still make their own decisions. And I don't find it likely that a lot of people are itching to go to a large, large social event.
Well, you know, speaking of that, since we're on the subject, BitBlock Boom is the conference I put on. And I guess I'm going to use this second for my segue and then we'll discuss it. If you're not familiar with BitBlock Boom out there, it's a conference I hold. This will be our third year in Dallas, Texas, scheduled for the end of August. You can check it out. It's still, we've got it back on because we're feeling good about it here in Texas. You can go to bitblockboom.com to look at information and see who's speaking. And we do have a checkout discount. You can use it at checkout for 30% off. Use the code word COUSINS at checkout and you'll receive 30% off. But that's the conference. Now, I want to get that out of the way, but we were really kicking ass on selling tickets for BitBlock Boom. And it died in maybe middle of March, you know, tickets just died. But now all of a sudden they pick back up when we're selling tickets like every other day now. So we're going to go for it and work on doing it properly, but it's not a huge conference. It would be 300 people max, which is a nice size conference, but it's not like, I guess once you get over 100 people, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's 300 or 4,000.
Sure.
You know, when you really get to it, it's going to be the same odds, but we're having a lot of people buy tickets now and a lot of interest again. I think maybe it's because of the fact that the age, maybe it's a combination of the fact that the age of our average attendee and the type of people in Bitcoin are people who don't want to be told what to do and want to do whatever in the hell they want. So I think maybe it's a combination is why our ticket sales are doing so well.
And we sounds like a good Bitcoiner, not people tell them what to do.
Tomorrow, we should be signing our platinum sponsor. For the deal, who had agreed to do it before the event, but I didn't hold him to it because we had not made 100% commitment. And I talked to him the other day and they said they're still behind it and want to go with it. So I think the fact that Texas, I'm just guessing, with the fact that Texas has been undone for a while, so many cities now are unlocking, and it's like 110 here when this is happening, and it's the end of August. I think most of the country is going to be unlocked by the end of August. I'm kind of concerned with the people coming from Europe as to whether they're going to get here. Like Stephen Lavera, he's one of the speakers in Australia, and he's still planning on coming. He's just saying he's hoping he can get here. I don't know. Like I said, I think BitBlock Boom seems to have a lot of people wanting to come. And I think, as Matt Odell made a tweet some time ago, and I'm not like taking any credit for this, so don't get me wrong, but he tweeted, having a conference in the end of August in Dallas, Texas, maybe the most genius idea anyone had, because no one's going to have had a Bitcoin conference. It would be the second one maybe of the year.
Right. You'd be the only the only show in town.
Yeah. So I'm also starting to wonder, and I'm not speaking about Kraken. I'm just talking in general. I'm wondering if I'm going to see a growth here in people wanting to sponsor BitBlock Boom. Because they've had all these funds they had dedicated for Bitcoin 2000 in San Francisco or Consensus or all these things they were going to do. And they go, we haven't done anything, you know, and now we got all this capital sitting there. We had dedicated to marketing and, you know, let's do it. So I'm kind of confused or wondering, not confused, wondering if I'm going to get hit with that, which would be great.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we look at how humans respond to incentives, how humans interact with the market, like, it seems natural that if you're the supply of one and demand increases unexpectedly, which I think a lot of people aren't expecting demand to increase, but if demand increases, then there should be an over, you know, essentially an oversubscription for the limited amount of supply, which is your conference in August. I think that, you know, this might be an interesting segue into like Texas and Bitcoiners. Well, I think, you know, like your conference is, you know, you're Texan. And I think Texans are this kind of fierce independent culture is very much across every city in Texas. And I think a lot of people don't really understand Texans. And, you know, when I first heard about Bitcoin, you know, people forget that the University of Texas requested physical delivery of their gold from the Fed. Like what university does that outside of Texas, right?
Right. And they're making, I believe, the state of Texas are making a vault.
Yeah.
Like their own version of Fort Knox to put the gold in.
Yeah, Texas doesn't trust the federal government to that extent, which is incredible. I love Texans because we don't trust, we verify. Like that's kind of born into Texas culture because we were our own independent country. I think it was like for 50 or 60 years, you know. So that kind of fierce independent resiliency is what I loved about Texas. And I think very much shaped my libertarian ideology and ultimately why I found Bitcoin. And it's been interesting though, because I haven't seen Texans in mass really, you know, kind of pick up Bitcoin. I know there's a good contingent in Dallas and Austin, but you know, it's not like a giant, giant hub. And
yeah, you're correct.
If you were to have asked me in 2013, where is Bitcoin going to start? I would have been like, oh, Texas, these people get it. It's about sovereignty over your body with weapons, like with guns, sovereignty over your money with gold. It's the perfect fit to be a Bitcoiner. I think the only thing missing was the technological component. It's still a little techy, a little kind of funky. And I think Texans aren't, they're not like the San Francisco folks who we hear about something new and we're like, oh, let's go check that out.
Yeah. Now, Austin is a good hub for Bitcoin when you're talking about in Texas. And I would have to think Austin's the best, but I'm often surprised at how weak Dallas-Fort Worth is as far as being a hub. I mean, you know, if you try to get a Bitcoin thing going, well, I have more people from New York come to BitBlock Boom than I do from Dallas, you know, and that's just crazy because they just got to drive down the street and they don't have to stay in a hotel.
Right.
I may have more people from Europe this year than I have from Dallas.
And what do you think is the issue with Texans and people from Dallas about Bitcoin?
I don't know. I really don't. Anything, there's no good groups. I'm not saying there's no good groups. There's no strong groups. Let me rephrase that. You know, if you use Meetup trying to find stuff, you'll see events and there'll be five people at a central market. You know, you don't see, and you look at the names and there's no one you know. And I know people in the area that are Bitcoiners, but they don't seem to. And I see them more when I go, like, if I would have gone to San Francisco for Bitcoin 2020, I would have seen people there from Dallas who I go, only time I see you is when I come out here, you know, or something. I don't see you at any events in Dallas. So I'm really confused. I know that people, when they come here from out of town, for instance, I can't remember who it was that was talking to me some time ago. They said, oh, I loved it. I got off a plane and I caught an Uber and I went straight to Bitcoin and Bullets and was shooting a gun, you know, within an hour, you know, because they can't do that where they're at. You know, and so, you know, one of the events that goes on, started last year and it's going to happen this year, is out of the gun range, you know, on Thursday. And people who are from out of town, especially are from out of the country, they love it. They're getting to go see all kinds of guns, shoot all kinds of guns. And I don't put that on. That's an event put on by someone else. There's a lot of events floating around BitBlock Boom that aren't mine. I'm actually trying to hopefully someday, you know, BitBlock Boom will start on Monday and end on Sunday, and like maybe Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are other people's events.
Oh, nice.
You know?
And like a mega event, and then you have like...
Yeah, and events. Then Friday comes in mine, or maybe at the end of every day, we'll have like a dinner somewhere that'll be put on by BitBlock Boom that people can go to, something to keep it condemned. But I love having satellite events that people are putting on.
Well, the gun one that you brought up was interesting because a lot of people, like Texans kind of understand this intimately, which is sovereignty over your body. I find it really bizarre that some Bitcoiners don't believe in, you know, solid gun rights. I think that a lot of Bitcoiners are like the West Coast, East Coast, you know, the coastal folks who don't really, you know, embrace sovereignty over their body, which I find pretty funny because they embrace sovereignty over their money, which money is just a representation of time and energy that their body spent to earn it. So like the only way to enforce your property rights over that Bitcoin is to have some adequate defense to defend yourself.
Yeah.
And Texans are the only ones who seem to embrace this. You know, I joke about, you know, in college you date girls and they'd have like little pink guns in their purses or a pink shotgun under their bed. And people on the coasts think that's nuts. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't you want to defend yourself? Like, what's wrong with defending yourself?
It was like my wife for her 65th birthday. I got her a semi-automatic weapon, you know, and we're not crazy people running around. I mean, but, you know, she couldn't handle. I have a 357. And I have a 12 gauge and she can't handle either one of those. They're way too powerful for her. So I got a semi-automatic 22, holds 30 shots in the cartridge thing. So she can handle a 22, and that'll do plenty of damage. I mean, you know.
Maybe we could make a weak analogy to, you know, if you buy Bitcoin, but you hold it on a centralized exchange, it's like a 22, but maybe you're not ready to handle the shotgun. You know, the self-sovereignty to protect your own private key. But maybe once you get used to the 22, you can upgrade to the shotgun a little bit later down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she can shoot the shotgun. Just hurts her shoulder real bad. So
you gotta know what you're doing.
The shotgun's in the area of last resort, you know, that she can retreat to, you know. So if she needs a retreat to there, I've been taken out.
Spoken like a true Bitcoiner building out his Citadel plan.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's funny we had these guns. It's funny. It's really odd. We have, you know, because I've had the shotgun and the pistol forever. And they've been in a closet. And my wife is the one that's like, why do you have those guns in the closet? We need to get those out here. And I'm like, really? And she goes, yeah, we need to get those out here. You shouldn't have those in the closet. And I'm like, and that started, though, and with the coronavirus, she started getting more concerned about security with people being out of work. I think her concept was that things might get bad with society.
Yeah.
You know, and people are out of work. They need money. You're going to feed your kids. You're not going to let your kids starve. I mean, you know, so.
Yeah, right. I mean, if there's supply chain issues with food, then naturally humans are going to act in their own self-interest, which I can't blame them to do, but they just wouldn't do it with me.
Yeah, that's how we look at it. We're going to have ourselves protected. So that's the thing, because my wife also asked, you know, you always hear people talking about the Citadels, which you just mentioned, and how the end of the world's going to come and there's going to be Bitcoiners and no Bitcoiners. And my wife asked me that the night, we walk every mile night about 2 miles, and she goes, I don't understand this. You're saying all these people are going to be wanting their Bitcoin someday. And you meet these people who are rich and been in Bitcoin since 2010 and 11. How come they're out without security guards? How come they're just walking around not worried about people like taking them down? You know, they should have a lot of Bitcoin if they've been in it since then. And I said, well, I think people still have money, Kathy. I think that's the difference from, you know, people saying that if Bitcoin becomes world currency, there'll be Bitcoiners and non-Bitcoiners. Right now, there are Bitcoiners and non-Bitcoiners, but the non-Bitcoiners still have currency.
Right. I think the Citadel, because the Citadel story comes from, or the Citadel reference comes from a story on Reddit, The Time Traveler.
The Time Traveler, yeah.
This guy wrote this fan fiction story about coming back from the future and Bitcoin succeeds, but it's so scarce that it essentially like changes the whole economy and there's these the have and have nots. I think that's kind of like a, you know, it plays into like this, these sort of like common movie themes of the have and have nots, with the one with Matt Damon in the sci-fi movie where all the wealthy people live in the spaceship and all the poor people live on Earth.
He's trying to get up there.
Elysium, I think, is the name of the movie.
Right.
You know, I think it kind of plays into that. There's this sort of like the wealthy versus the have nots. And
also Lolita or whatever, the one about the robot girl.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See, there's cities up there floating above them, and all the peons live on the ground where they dump their trash.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they literally dump their trash. I forget about that.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's sort of a, I think it's this fear, you know, of like the mass populations. But right now we see, I mean, I walk around San Francisco, and I've hung out with people that are worth 100 million to a billion. And we walk on the streets openly, you know. Yeah. So, and San Francisco is not a safe city. Let's put it that way. Like, it's not a safe city, but even they feel safe enough to walk around like that without like two bodyguards. There's only a few people I know in the space that have, in the crypto space, that have bodyguards. I'm not going to name them, but I understand where they're coming from. But, you know, it does give me hope that if really wealthy people in San Francisco that are in tech can walk around, then Bitcoiners in the future could walk around freely as well. You know, I think the dystopian scenario that sort of represents would be an extreme breakdown of property rights and social norms.
Yeah, well, I think it's to that point, we are going to need the guns in my house. Yeah, hey, yeah. I was watching you on Max Kaiser, and actually, I was watching and said, wow, why haven't I called him yet and to set up an interview with him? And I think I emailed you right there while I was on the couch watching, so I saw you. But you went into something I found very interesting that I want to cover. You talked about, you were comparing Bitcoin to a living organism. And would you mind going over that? Because I found that pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I wrote a series called Planting Bitcoin, that Satoshi's brilliance wasn't just in the species of money that he chose to plant, but the seeds in the soil and the gardening techniques. And when we look at a money has certain genetic characteristics or genetic code, all puns intended for Bitcoin, a certain genetic code that manifests itself via traits. And these traits are what an organism has that enables it to survive. And so when we look at different monies, you have different traits of portability, fungibility, divisibility, all these sort of traits that make it a good species of money. And so when we look at historical species of money, like primitive forms before gold, like shells and beads, and then we had gold, and now we have fiat, and then you have Bitcoin. Through each evolution of money, so as money evolved and as certain traits of money became more favorable or more advantageous as a species, you know, essentially shells and beads went extinct as a money when gold came around because gold had superior traits. And then same with, you know, with Bitcoin replacing gold, because Bitcoin is digital. It's much more verifiable and divisible and portable. And also has a controlled supply that everyone knows versus one that where we don't know how much gold there is. And we do know that there's enough gold on asteroids to basically make gold worthless. So Bitcoin as a species of money has superior genetics, which give it better superior traits and basically makes it the next evolution of money. Bitcoin is the final evolution of money. And so when people go, oh, I think I should hold both gold and Bitcoin, I go, why? Bitcoin is the far superior species. It's kind of like, you know, looking at this new apex predator, like looking at a, you know, a dinosaur and being like that versus some new apex predator who's been honed over a huge amount of time to be that new species, that new apex predator. You wouldn't place your bet on the old one. You place your bet on the new one. And so, you know, that's where I think a lot of people feel that I'm being overly harsh when I'm critical of gold. Now, gold, I think, is still a good investment for in a short and medium term duration. But as younger age cohorts like millennials increasingly become older, what are they going to buy into? They're going to buy into Bitcoin. Bitcoin to them makes sense. We were the first age group. I'm in my 30s. We were the first age group to bridge the analog to digital. I grew up with cassette tapes, and now I stream my songs with Spotify. And so we were the first ones to like really grok Bitcoin in mass. You know, I think there's certainly other age groups who get it. And for gold, I mean, I don't know any of my friends who own gold. Like a lot of them own Bitcoin.
Right.
I kind of see Bitcoin as the apex predator of money, if you will.
But, you know, speaking on that same scenario, or not scenario, but what you just said, cassette tapes. You know, cassette tapes, I'm going to use this. This is a weird example I'm making. But people don't accept new technology quickly all the time. When I was in high school, I had a cassette tape player. All my friends had 8-tracks and they sucked. And I couldn't find, they didn't even have for your car a cassette player at the time. So I had an old car. I paid $350 for it. And I took my portable cassette deck and took the earphone plug and wired it into my speakers of the car so I could listen to my tapes. And all my friends would go, this is stupid. Why don't you get an 8-track? And I said, this is way better. I can record my own tapes off the radio.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they pop, I can open up the little box, tape it back together, and still listen to it. And I can forward fast it. I can rewind it. And no one would go, I don't know anyone in high school that had a cassette deck except me. But then over time, you know, they started getting more popular. They came out with in a car. I remember when my dad got a car with a cassette deck in it. And I was like, oh my gosh. And he was taking my cassette deck. So I remember he had Led Zeppelin. And he was putting it in there because all I had was hard rock. And my dad was an old country western guy, but he wanted to use his cassette deck. So he was sitting in the car listening to it. And I remember him going, oh my gosh, that's crazy when it goes, because in Whole Lot of Love, it goes from one side to the other, one side to the other. It's real strong stereo. And he was like, that's amazing. You know, where we never had that with the 8-track didn't seem to have that same effect on him. So, but it took a long time for that technology to get accepted. Just like now, going back to what we were talking about, just like it's taking a long time for Bitcoin to get accepted. And those were young people. So it's not necessarily just old people, which I hear all the time, that have a hard time moving into new technology. It's all people.
Totally. I think that's a great example. I mean, just because it's new technology doesn't mean everyone's going to adopt it overnight. It takes a long time. And that's where, you know, I also agree with you. It's not necessarily just young or old, but the young typically embrace new tech in greater size. You know, like yes. Everyone got on Facebook at the same age. And so that's where, you know, it's going to take, I think a lot of Bitcoiners don't get this, but this takes decades. I mean, I've been in now for, I would say 8 years is the more appropriate number of years I've been in it. And so like 8 years is a long time.
So I've just been in 3 years. I got in it mid 2017 before the big bull run happened. Luckily.
There's like different era. It's, I think when we look back on Bitcoin, we'll look back and we'll count the number of notches based on the number of halvings we've been through.
So you've been through, this was your third halving?
Yeah. I didn't really remember the 2012 one though. I was just playing around with it. I wasn't very serious about it. 13, I became much more serious once I got plugged into the community, read up really, really, really deeply on things, built my first product. So 16, I was paying attention. It wasn't, this 2016 halving wasn't that big though, compared to 2020. I mean, man, there was 2016. I went down to a party at BitGo's offices in the South Bay. And I think that maybe there was like 15 people there. So
if you put it in that perspective, this was a much bigger event, but I was kind of let down with the halving. You know, I was really expecting there to be even more, I think, you know, than there was.
Yeah, I mean, at Kraken, we were excited to participate, and we really wanted to put on. Now, Kraken's an old Bitcoin company. In fact, let's see. Yeah, I think this is an old Kraken t-shirt. It says Bitcoin Exchange.
Right.
This is an old one. This is
a retro.
Retro shirt. You know, and Kraken very much, I think, appeals to a wide variety of audiences, not just Bitcoiners. So I'm speaking kind of on my own behalf here. But, you know, with Kraken, we put our heads together and we're like, well, we want to make sure that we, you know, show Bitcoiners that we care. Like, it's kind of funny how these big exchanges don't show their biggest customer segment that they care. And so we put our heads together and we're like, I think a VR event would be pretty cool. Like, we're trying to come up with something different.
Yeah, that would be cool.
You know, we weren't sure, like, you know, a lot of people don't have VR headsets, but we were streaming it. So we loved the response that we got. So on the halving, we had the Kraken VR event, which was super fun. And I got to thank Pete Rizzo, who really kind of architected that. And Pierre Rochard did a lot of hard work there too. And so that was fun. I think it was, you know, it was funny to see like companies like Coinbase, though, not really do anything for the halving. You know, it's kind of funky. We felt like we had to do something for the halving to show you know, Bitcoiners that we cared.
Yeah, I think this was my first halving. So I think next time that BitBlock Boom will do something itself. But being the first time, I just wanted to participate. Yeah, I'm one of those people, I feel like I'm not very good at inventing the wheel, but I can put good hubcaps on the wheel once I see it. You know, I can put better hubcaps on it. Does that make any sense? But yeah. But I can't invent a wheel for hell. But once I see a wheel, I can go, oh, hell, that would look great with these different hubcaps and change it up.
I don't think any idea just like pops into someone's head without any inspiration from the outside. While we might look at relativity, you know, with Einstein coming up with that or Isaac Newton, they certainly were inspired by other events and other people in their life. You know, there's no one exists in a vacuum. And so I think a lot of people feel like they're not contributing that much when they just change something and then make it shinier or change the color of the hubcaps. But actually, one of the most successful companies in the world, Apple, literally does that. Apple doesn't typically build the newest iteration of something. They build the most usable newest iteration, you know, where they're not going to go pioneer a new camera type, or they might. But typically what they do is they get the most stable camera type that people can use and that's really easy to use. And then they polish that and make it easy and simple.
Well, I always say Apple didn't invent the phone. You know, the phone was invented a long time ago, but they sure made a lot of money off phones.
Yeah, the BlackBerry invented the smartphone. Apple just made it usable and made it.
I had a Trio, I think, smartphone.
Is this like a Palm Pilot era one?
Yeah, it was like a Palm Pilot. It was a little bit better than a Palm Pilot, you know. But it had a physical keyboard on it, and when people would see it, they go, "Oh my gosh."
It was huge. I mean, I remember when BlackBerries were super hot. I mean, if people forget, I mean, if you feel old saying this, I forget when the iPhone came out, but the iPhone 3G was my first iPhone. And the 3G, you know, finally got the form factor down. And that was super popular. And I got that in college. But I think my first phone in college was a flip phone. You know, like, you know, just had like text messaging capabilities. You could kind of browse the web, but it was really clunky.
Right. Yeah, I went from a Trio to the first iPhone that came out. Actually, I had every iPhone until they quit doing the credit deal where you could use your time. You know, you got so many, because I would sell my old one and it would be cheaper. I had four phones on my plan, so every year I could sell one, make $10 more than it cost to buy a new one. You know, because it was included in your phone bill type thing.
Right. It was like semi subsidized by AT&T or something. Right.
Right. Right. So, like I said, my wife usually bitches when I spend money, but she was like, well, that's cool. We made 10 bucks and you got the new phone you wanted, you know? So with four phones, I could do it every year and none of the kids were worried about a phone. They just liked having a phone that was paid for.
And I think people forget about, you know, when you spend money as like, and then we can tie this into hodling, which is that, you know, I'm obviously huge into hodling. I think hodling teaches you more things than just holding Bitcoin and believing in Bitcoin. It teaches you how to be a good investor, how to be convicted in a trade, how to be convicted with something in life, how to go about formulating an investment thesis and then sticking with it. But also people forget, like, you don't HODL for forever. I mean, technically you can, and you could, for example, if you HODLed Bitcoin long enough, you could just lend your Bitcoin out and earn interest on it. So technically you never have to sell to live a lifestyle. But we are humans after all. We require food and shelter, and, you know, people forget that we don't live forever. So, you know.
But see, I was, matter of fact, I was on a conference, party, whatever you want to call it, a Bitcoin thing. There were about 25 people on it. And someone was talking about when they're going to sell. And I said, wait a second, you got to realize there, no one should sell until it hits a million or something. And I was like, you got to realize, I mean, I'm 65. I'm not going to wait for a million. I got 20 years left. You know what I mean? It's a different reality for me versus someone else. Unless I just want to live like I live now forever. And then my kids are like, well off, which I don't have a problem with them being well off, but I don't live for my kids to be well off.
Sure. You're, you know, when you want to have a nice life.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd like for my last 20 years to be able to just, I enjoy myself now, but believe me, if Bitcoin starts hitting $100,000, I'll start selling some. I promise you, I got 20 years left.
Which is totally fine. I feel like a lot of Bitcoiners kind of guilt other ones into doing that. And look, my name's Dan Held, right? I've been HODLing for 8 years, but certainly, like, if you have a partner, a wife or husband, and they're like, you know, it's time for us to get a home, I really want to start a family. Yeah. That's what's really important in life. You know, I'm a single guy. I've got a girlfriend who's luckily into Bitcoin as much as I am, which is pretty cool. And that was before I met her.
Well, that's real cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I'm pretty fortunate to have found her. You know, so she understands the trade, but I understand that a lot of people's partners really don't understand it. And they have certain life events like a car or house that they need. You know, you have to be realistic. Like, I can HODL really, really hard, but I'm also a single, you know, technically a single male, and I don't have kids or a mortgage. So it's a little bit easier for me. So I totally understand people's plights when they can't. Yeah. But you should hold on to some for as long as you can. You know, like, you got to hold on to, I would never sell more than half my coins. I personally could never do that. I would just do the lending, or maybe sell super out of the money covered calls or something. Of course, these strategies come with risk, but, you know, if you want to HODL forever, you have to eventually generate a cash flow. You could do joint markets. You could actually be a liquidity provider for coin joins. That's a safer way to do it. But yeah, I think about that a lot, though, which is like, what if you could HODL for forever? How do you generate an income off of your Bitcoin? And that's where I started to experiment with different lending products. And I won't talk about specific ones on the show. And I think a lot of people feel very strongly against, you know, lending and borrowing products or covered calls or something, but nothing risked, nothing gained. You're free to HODL your coins in the safest and very responsible manner, which is to self-custody your coins, and you don't have to trust anyone else. And I think that's what most people should do. But if you want to feel a little bit more risky, or maybe you've HODLed for 15 years.
Right. It's all according to what you got into it. I mean, everybody's perspective is different. It's all according to your age, where you're at in life, what your bills are, how much you got into it. If you bought Bitcoin at a dollar, and you're sitting on a lot of it, you're perfectly content getting $10,000, $20,000 because you probably have enough of it that it's not going to wreck you. And you're still going to do fine if it reaches $100,000 or $1 million.
Totally. Yeah, it's totally case dependent. And I feel like sometimes with Bitcoiners, we're a little bit harsh when it comes to the advice of like HODL forever. I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to rewind or undo all of the programming that central banks and Keynesian ideology has done, which is wiring people for consumption. And I think that's why Bitcoin HODLing is bigger than just Bitcoin. Bitcoin HODLing is about like reducing your time preference, like extending your horizon for a very long period of time and being committed and choosing an investment thesis that takes a long time to see. You know, you can't just bet on something and it play out over a year and you feel like you won. To beat the market, you inherently have to bet against the market because the market is under, as you hypothesize, the market is undervaluing the asset that you just purchased. And so that's where I think Bitcoin is really great, when it forces you to reevaluate your expenses. It forces you to reevaluate other investment options. I think it's a great, you know, entry into basic finance and basic, personal finance and basic investing.
Yeah, I have to agree with you completely. Hey, I've got it. I asked on Twitter people if they had any questions for you. So this is getting kind of long. I usually do it like an hour. We're going to go over that. So I'm going to go to some of these questions, and some of them may not make sense to me. So maybe they do. You like at Charleston Jazz Club said, when are you coming to Charleston, South Carolina? Do you go there a lot?
I don't make it. If I'm going to the East Coast, I'm typically going up to New York or Boston. I don't make it down there very often, but if I do, I'll give you guys a shout out.
Okay, because, yeah, it was time to rally the troops, he says. And then at Lystra, well, we know the answer to this, A&M or UT, he's an A&M guy.
Yep, A&M guy. We actually have a couple, you know, I've met him in person.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
He was a bit block boom last year. He bought Jimmy Song's hat at the auction.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Jimmy, that was the first time Jimmy auctioned his hat off was at the dinner on Friday night, and he had bought it. He's a real nice guy.
Yeah, you know, I really care a lot about A&M, and I think that they don't really get a good perspective at A&M of the outside world, like the West Coast and tech. And I kind of stumbled and bumbled my way out here. So I work with a startup, Aggieland, which is a sort of a way for Aggies to get exposure to startups and West Coast tech entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. So whenever they come out here, I grab drinks and dinner with them. When I worked at Uber, I gave them a tour of Uber. You know, trying to bring Bitcoiners out here. It's something that's important to me. I think Texans are good people and hardworking people and smart people. And I think we need more of them on the coasts.
I think you need more of them everywhere.
Exactly.
Okay, this is from Crypto Cloaks. What is Project Apollo? And he puts rolling on the floor laughing.
Crypto Cloaks and I have been working on a stealth project. It's I'm fully employed at Kraken, and this is not going to change that. But Crypto Cloaks, what he does is he builds different 3D printed devices for Bitcoiners.
Oh, he makes the hand grenades.
Yeah, that's right. He makes those. For people listening, that's a plastic thing.
But it's made to store open dimes inside of it.
Yeah, he has a couple different products. Some are ways to stealth hide your treasures or ledgers or your backups. And then he also has like plastic full node shells.
For open nose or whatever.
Yeah, so him and I have been working on something very, very special. This is more fun. This is not a full-time thing. This is something I've been doing for fun, working with him on designing this item. And so Project Apollo is what we codenamed it. And I think when Bitcoiners see it, it's going to, I think people are really going to like it. I've got a tweet storm coming out about this. I don't know if you noticed with my personal brand, how it's kind of turned black and white and a little bit more sci-fi, like on my Twitter and some of the tweets I've been putting out, the black and white tweets, kind of more crisp and clean and sci-fi aesthetic. So I feel that Bitcoin's cool, but I wanted to make it feel, for what I feel about Bitcoin is that it's like a futuristic sci-fi novel. Like Bitcoin's amazing. It's incredible. And so I'm designing, you know, I'm kind of re-architecting my personal brand and trying to make and designing graphics to make Bitcoin understandable and also feel really cool. At least I subjectively feel that way. And it seems like people are liking it. So this, what I'm building with Project Apollo, fits right into that.
Well, I'm ready to see Project Apollo. Any estimated date of arrival, ETA, time of arrival?
I'm filming the promo video this week. So soon.
Soon. Okay. This is from Dergigi. I think this is kind of a cute one. How does it feel to have held your whole life?
I got a very fortunate roll of the dice when it comes to my last name. Yeah. Kind of like with a blacksmith or like the last name Smith, how they used to be blacksmiths. Well, maybe held. I was always meant to hodl. It's a German last name, by the way.
Oh, is it?
It means hero in German.
Oh, that's cool. Okay. This is from SZ Kabasabi. Can you get him a remote part-time job at Kraken? Customer service?
I think I told him to check out the careers page. We got quite a few different roles open. If you're interested in working at Kraken, we are remote first. So you can work anywhere you'd like. And you can work at Kraken, which is awesome because we've got a lot of great roles open. And I think the salaries are pretty competitively priced for, you know, if you live somewhere cheap, you can kind of arbitrage that difference.
Yeah, I've had to use customer service one time for my account, and I have no idea who I talked to, but they were very helpful. I mean, they took care of my issues. So I got to say, the customer service was super helpful. I mean, it was super helpful. Next one is from Matthew Wyron Case. Do you like beef jerky, riverboat gambling, or samurai swords?
You know, that's a really tough decision. I like kind of like the gourmet beef jerky where it's like, you know, like elk or caribou or something where it's like a little bit more exotic.
Have you seen this beef jerky? Steak strips?
No. Oh, they're like little pieces of steak.
Yeah. Premium cut and cured dried beef from Kirkland. I bought it one day and it's really good. It's actually like steak.
Oh, that sounds pretty awesome. I like different flavors though. There's a beef jerky stand up in Colorado where I go every summer and winter. We've got a family cabin out there, and there's like they've got like caribou, elk. They've got crazy sort of flavors. I think that's kind of fun. So I'd have to go with beef jerky there.
Okay. This is from KG2931. Why is Dan the only Bitcoin guy from the early San Francisco meetup? Seems like the rest of those people became pretty intense shitcoiners.
Yeah, that's a pretty good question. There actually is, you know, I remember seeing that comment. I forgot to reply. Brian Vu was there as well. So Brian Vu is on the Lightning team. So he's kind of one of the founding people on Lightning, the Lightning Labs with Elizabeth Stark. So Brian Vu is there. Charlie Lee, even though he created Litecoin, if you talk to him and publicly, he's basically said he's a Bitcoiner.
And he posts pretty positive things about, I mean, if you look at his posts and really he'll even, you even see him say, Bitcoin's going to be it.
Yeah. Yeah. He basically just made Litecoin for fun, but he, most of his holdings are Bitcoin and he's really just a Bitcoiner, right? I mean, that's, he's publicly said that. And if you ask him in private too, I think he'll be like, yeah, I'm really super bullish on Bitcoin. So I'd say Charlie's in that camp as well.
Well, he sold his Litecoin at a good time.
Well, he was kind of damned if he did, damned if he didn't, right? Like, yeah. If you sell it and it goes up, people are going to make fun of you. If you sell it and then it drops, then people are going to be like, oh, you sold the top. But like, no one knows what the top's going to be, right? So I feel bad for the guy because it was really, he did it the most honorable way I thought you could, which is publicly disclosing it.
Yeah, no, he did disclose. Like I said, it just is a fact. He definitely sold it at the right time.
He timed it perfectly. Charlie's a good trader. He, you know, he's a big poker guy. I've gambled with him in Vegas too. He's a lot of fun. But yeah, he's a pretty sharp investor.
Okay, the next one is from Robert Robot Visions. If something goes wrong with Bitcoin and all the hodlers throw in the towel, what will happen next?
Bitcoin dies.
Yeah, I would have a hard time believing something could happen to make.
Well, and that brings up a good point, which is that I often say that Bitcoin only dies if we all stop believing in it. Every hodler would have to not believe in it and not be the bid for the price, and the price would go to zero. So yeah, in that scenario, Bitcoin dies, but it dies because it died in everyone's mind. Like we all stopped believing in it, which makes it the same with the dollar or gold. If everyone tomorrow was like, I don't think gold is just a shiny rock. I don't really want to buy it. I don't think it has any sort of monetary, you know, premium, then certainly gold would go to zero as well.
It's kind of like that. Do you remember that YouTube video that came out a couple years ago of the like caveman or something going to buy a chicken and he pulls out a piece of gold? And he goes, I got this rock and it's going to be really big. And the guy goes, can I eat it? Nope. Can I do this? Nope. I don't want that rock. You know,
it doesn't have utility, right?
Yeah.
I love that argument about Bitcoin. No, it doesn't have any utility. I'm like, its store value properties are what give it utility.
Okay. The last one is from Victor Erim. Assuming a future Bitcoin market cap of less than 100 trillion and scaling issues resolved through Lightning or Semior tech, does Dan eventually envision a world in which Bitcoin is the only money in existence? We sometimes hear analysts say Bitcoin pegged fiat might continue in such a world.
Okay, so that's the whole question. So essentially, I guess what he's asking is that Bitcoin achieves its gold 2.0 status, fully legitimized, fully recognized as that, probably not just gold 2.0, but essentially killed gold. If it's 100 trillion market cap, that means that Bitcoin was a resounding success. An absolute maximal success, you know. And so I guess the question is, like, how does Bitcoin scale? I don't think you can't really say that, like, without Lightning or other implementations, because we've already seen those work on production. Like, these aren't theoretical scaling improvements. They're currently running. This isn't like, will it work or not? And in fact, like, you know, if two exchanges wanted to open up a Lightning channel between them for their traders to send money back and forth, you know, they can do that already. So like that would reduce on-chain volume by X percentage, right? Like just between two exchanges, like a lot of the volume is like arbitrage traders moving funds between exchanges, traders moving funds. And so, you know, even if Lightning is basically a B2B tool, it would still be massively successful in terms of making Bitcoin more efficient or compressing the economic activity into one transaction. Similarly, we have Liquid, which is fully up and running with Blockstream. So that's been on mainnet for a long time now. And we've got other solutions as well. You know, people forget that, you know, on layer one, we've got the Bitcoin blockchain. Layer two, you've got Lightning, Liquid. And then layer three, you've got, you know, companies like Coinbase and Kraken, where Coinbase can and Kraken can send transactions to their users internally, and they're just changing an internal database or things like that. So I think with that sort of scaling pyramid in mind, where you have a few transactions on layer one, many more on layer two, and sort of infinite capacity on layer three, I don't really have any doubt that Bitcoin, given 100 trillion market cap, will be able to scale to meet the requirements of the world.
Okay. Well, where can people follow you at?
Well, if you're on Twitter, I'm at Dan Held. If you'd like to read more long form content, I'm danheld.com/blog. You're going to find a lot of my thoughts on proof of work, planting Bitcoin, which is Bitcoin's origin story, Satoshi's fairness of his distribution, what role hodlers play. And if you're worried about Bitcoin's long-term security, I wrote a comprehensive take on that.
And before we go, is there anything that you might have wanted to promote or bring up that I didn't cover? I want to make sure I don't cut you off and there's something you wanted to cover during this conversation.
I think we covered it. We brought up Project Apollo, which I think everyone's going to find really interesting. It's kind of fun. It's been a little, you know, it's my entertainment under quarantine, essentially. So yeah, Project Apollo is going to be really cool. You know, if you like my content or if you have anything, any suggestions, please feel free to reach out or tweet at me. I largely kind of build what I believe is cool and produce content what I believe is cool, but that comes with a lot of feedback from the community. So don't feel afraid to tweet at me and tell me what you think.
Cool. You are, just to let you know, you're officially a crypto cousin now.
Glad to be
part of the family. Hey, thanks for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it, Dan. It's went a little longer than I had told you it would, but I appreciate you not being in a hurry and taking the time. And I look forward to seeing you again wherever it happens. You know, I'm sure within the next year, there's going to be somewhere we're going to run into each other.
I hope so. I'm excited to, I do quite a bit of the conferences in the space, and I'm kind of itching to get back to having a drink with a couple Bitcoiners at a bar.
Well, we need to maybe get you out here, see your parents, and come to Blog Boom.
Yeah, I mean, Dallas is my home city, so I think it's time to come back to my hometown.
Well, thanks for taking the time with me on the show. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Gary. Cheers.
I hope you've enjoyed today's show, and I want to give a big thank you to all my cousins out there for listening and subscribing. If you haven't subscribed yet, just go to CryptoCousins.com and you'll see the links for all the places you can subscribe. You may want to take a second and leave a great review or a 4-star rating even while you're at it. I also recommend you go to CryptoPodcaster.com and see all my other podcasts and websites for the world of Bitcoin. There's a lot of them to look at.
Thanks for listening to the Crypto Cousins podcast. Please share the show with your friends. They can subscribe by going to CryptoCousins.com/subscribe. And if you want to know more about Gary, just go to GaryLeland.com. Make sure and join Gary and all the Crypto Cousins every week for a new episode of the Crypto Cousins podcast. The Crypto Cousins podcast and the information included in the podcast are not intended as investment advice. Investing in any cryptocurrency is risky, and you should never invest more than you can afford to lose. Always seek professional advice before investing in any cryptocurrency. Please understand, you are using any and all information from the Crypto Cousins at your own risk.